This morning I want to talk about Passover. Passover begins this Friday evening at dusk and continues for 8 days. It's one of Judaism's major holidays, and it is probably the origin of Christianity's Last Supper. More on that next week. Over the years, my predecessors here at ESUC have organized and led many a Seder meal here at church. And in fact, this coming Saturday, you see in the bulletin, there's a Passover Seder here, 5 to 9, led by the humanistic by the secular Jewish circle of Puget Sound. And they usually do one here every year, and this year it'll be on Saturday. Now, this is true in most Unitarian churches. So there's Passover, and we call the Passover Seder. But here's the thing about all these myths. Myth and ritual go together. So myth is the narrative description of the story. Ritual is acting it out. And you can't have the one without the other. They always go together. The Passover story is the myth. The Seder meal is the ritual. Myth tells the story. Ritual acts out the story. Now, the Passover story goes like this, basically. The Jews lived as slaves in Egypt. Moses led them out of Egypt through the Red Sea to Israel. We all know that story. But here's what actually happened, at least according to Norman Gottwald, my Old Testament professor. 3,300 years ago, in the Fertile Crescent, Egypt ruled the land of Canaan more or less like a colony. Political turmoil led to a situation in which the slave caste slowly began to organize themselves over the following 200 years until they ran the show. They established a new political kingdom over the course of those two centuries. And what was especially impressive about their state was that it was based on a new way of organizing. Yahweh, the collective spirit of the people, was to be in charge. No pharaoh, no king, no body. No person. The king was the shared collective spirit, Yahweh, the spirit of the people. That was to be in charge. Now, this was a radically democratic way to organize politically at the time. It still is today. So you have this situation developing where the Egyptian Empire in Canaan that had been running the show there over the course of a couple of hundred years getting pushed out. Egypt, it turns out, is more of a frame of mind than a place. Indeed, the word Egypt in Hebrew means the narrow place. The narrow place. That's in Hebrew. The word for that is Egypt, which is a perfect description of the culture there before the Jews took control of their fate by joining together and daring to live radically as one community bound together. Bound by a shared spirit, Yahweh, bound together by a covenant like the one we recited every week, and bound together by stories. The Passover story associated with Exodus and the various rituals that go along the Seder meal. Now, I've mentioned before my mentor, when my first church as a young minister by myself was in Danbury, Connecticut, and old Jerome Molino was the rabbi emeritus who'd been first called to the United Jewish Center in 1933, and he's a long background here, but he took me under his wing. I had no choice, and tried to raise me up in the ways of appropriate religious professionalism, and I'm still trying to live up to all that he said. But one thing he said, you universalist Unitarians, which he always said it that way, you universalist Unitarians are a lot like us Jews, but we have rituals. Moses is an example of the hero archetype, or the lost king archetype, who there's a crisis. First, children of the Jews are threatened. His mother, we know this story, she put him in a little cradle that floated down the Nile, and the next thing you know, he escapes detection. He's found by a princess in the palace, and there he's brought up. He has an excellent education, and he becomes comrades or friends with all the court. So years later, though, he gets this benefit of this education and this special relationships with the powers that be, but he's still a shepherd, and he's out taking care of his flock. And suddenly, he is spoken to by Yahweh, or he hears his voice, the burning bush story, we know that. Let my people go, says this person, says, take your shoes off. He says, let my people go. And Moses, just like any one of us, goes, huh? Why me? I mean, I'm the last guy to do this job. First of all, I have a speech impediment, which it's true in the Bible. He stuttered. How can I be effective in marshaling all our people and going up against Pharaoh, the toughest guy on the planet at the time? He says, no, you're my guy. You're going. And he tries to get out of it again and again. And finally he says, okay, who shall I say sent me? Because I'm going to go back and try to tell my compatriots it's time to go. I've been instructed by Yahweh. And they go, huh? So he said, who shall I say sent me? Not really allowed to say Yahweh. I'm saying it, but you're not supposed to. So who do I say sent me? And the voice says, I am that I am. Or actually, the scholars prefer the I cause to be what I cause to be. But basically, it's the verb to be. In the Western tradition, our name for the deity is the verb to be. If you want to get close to the spirit, find your own way to be self-expressive as your own being. And you need a good community to kind of launch you in that direction. Anyway, finally he's convinced. He goes to Pharaoh and he tells him, let my people go. And Pharaoh dismisses him. Are you kidding? And then he says, well, then you're going to get these plagues. I'm promising you 10, you know, a bunch of grasshoppers and frogs and whatever. And it escalates right to the 10th plague of the death of the firstborn children and cattle, which in many cases was a worse blow to them. Moses tells all his fellow slaves about the imminent death of the firstborn and how to avoid it. And then after death affects every household in Egypt, Pharaoh tells Moses and his brother to leave immediately, and they do. That's the Passover story. There you go. Now the Exodus story came to be associated with Passover, but the origin of Passover is actually much older. Indeed, the name Passover comes from the Hebrew verb pasah, to skip, or Passover, so named because of the tradition that the destroyer passed over the houses marked with the blood of the Paschal lamb when so many others were smoked. Pastoral in origin, etymologists believe that the festival may actually be named for the skipping of lambs. As we've all seen, they frisk and bounce and gamble about, those two on the cover of the order of service. They're so charming and delightful and remind us of children. Lambs and baby goats, or kids, are the specific animals, incidentally, designated by Hebraic law for sacrifice in connection with the ancient pastoral celebration. The verb to skip, has many meanings. To pass along with light springing movements. Sometimes to ricochet as a missile passing rebounds along a surface, as in skipping stones. Or to pass from one point or thing to another with disregard or omission of what intervenes, just kind of to skip about apparently randomly. Or to leave hastily, to flee. All these meanings are tied up in the Exodus story. Who among us has not, at one point or another in their lives, gambled freely and with great joy? Who hasn't skipped out in the nick of time, or maybe, or regretfully, to the dismay of someone who was counting on you to hang in there? Who hasn't prayed that they would be skipped over for a tongue lashing, for a tough assignment, or for a dangerous tour of duty? Please, Mr. Cussman, I don't want to go. The Exodus story is a story about all these things, but especially about praying to be passed over and having your prayers answered. Try not to get hung up on the literal dimensions of the myth, of any myth, if you want to understand it. This is true of all mythology. If you get strung up on the literalism, you're just like the fundamentalists. You know, they're stuck on it, you know, and then you can get stuck in a negative way. It's not about the literal. They're metaphors. Our spiritual ancestors were originally, here's the point, our ancestors were slaves. That is, they lived as unfree people. Then they adopted a covenant. Then they started holding themselves accountable to that covenant. And then, what do you know? They began to thrive. They made it through the turbulent, life-threatening waters of the Red Sea, that is, metaphorically. They made it through a period of fear and uncertainty and on to dry ground. It took them a while, 40 years in the wilderness, followed by fits and starts for hundreds of years more. But eventually, they learned how to live as free people. Genesis, Exodus, these are foundational stories, myths of origin. The Passover Exodus myth, in its simplest terms, it seems to me, comes down to this. Our freedom derives from our willingness to bind ourselves together in covenant. Let me say that again. Our freedom derives from our ability to bind ourselves together in covenant. Free religion, after all, is not a free for all. It's disciplined and demanding. It asks of us everything, just as Allah René Bozarth echoed in the 11 Voices meditation. Pack nothing, bring only your determination to serve and your willingness to be free. Do not hesitate to leave your old ways behind, fear, silence, submission. Sing songs as you go. Remain true to the mystery. Pass on the story. Do not go back. Over the millennia since the Passover festival first started to evolve, it has continued to change, to embellish, and to transform. As Judaism evolved from a family to a tribal to a national religion and beyond, the prayer that its adherents be passed over when it comes to unbearable heartache, that prayer has been repeated millions of times and will be again this coming week across Judaism the world over. This morning, we gather to affirm the heart of Passover, that liberation is costly because living by a covenant is difficult and demanding. But difficult as living by a covenant may be, living without leads to inevitable discord and distraction and to loss of vision. Making church thrive is actually a lot more fun than discord, distraction, and loss of vision. Sometimes it's almost like skipping, lightly prancing about, being festive and playful as baby lambs and kids are. But at other times, sticking with our covenant, being peaceful, truthful, and trying to be helpful, toward everybody, at times adhering to such a covenant can test a body to their absolute limit. For Unitarian Universalists, or as Rabbi Molino would put it, for Universalist Unitarians, our covenant is our spiritual practice. It's how liberal, non-orthodox, agnostic-leaning religionists such as ourselves can grow in community and spirit. The concept of covenant has grown over the centuries. What for Abraham and Sarah was a covenant between their family and its daemon grew into a larger and larger circle, encircling over the centuries more and more of humanity. Let us resolve this day to follow our forebears' noble, costly example and to choose freedom, to choose binding ourselves to one another and in covenant with your minister temporarily, but within a few years with your next minister, all in hopeful expectation of growing our souls and strengthening this, our beloved community. To choose, as it's written in the 13th chapter of Deuteronomy, and as I'll recite in our closing words, to choose life so that our descendants and this wonderful community may truly live. May it be so. Amen. And shalom.